Would you introduce yourselves, please?
Okay. Hey, I'm Tim Wheeler from Ash.
And I'm Mark, the bass player, Mark Hamilton.
Let's see. We've got age 12. We've got high school. You were bad at football. You named the... Oh, yeah. We're not going to do... You named the band off the first short word that you could find. See? We didn't spend an hour on that. We could have. From the dictionary. In 93, you topped the local charts. In 94, it was my friend Steve Lamack at Radio 1. There was Warner Brothers. There was DreamWorks. You did Rockfield Studios. Did Dave Edmonds drop by when you did that by any chance?
They talked about him a lot, but he wasn't there.
But you obviously used the reverb chamber to your max.
Oh, yeah, we did, yeah.
It's like the greatest reverb next to Phil Spector, right?
Oh, it's amazing. Well, one night we were working, and we started hearing like some weird shouting going on over our record, and we were like, where is this coming from? And we eventually tracked down. It was like one of the other bands in the other studio was in there in this echo chamber on acid, dancing to our track and having a great party. Loving the sound of it.
Well, you see, but that's great focus group testing for the record.
Yeah, it was winning, yeah. They were in there for a long time until we got them out.
Oh my gosh. 2007, last quote official album, then the A to Z singles, 2013 for South by Southwest in 10 years, and now Kablamo. How'd I do?
Pretty good, yeah. Yeah.
Compressed 23 years.
Well, can I dispel a lie? A common story back home, at least. This is a very Northern Irish thing, and we're from Northern Ireland. And our first hit single was a song called Girl from Mars. And still to this day, I hear people back home, they keep talking about a town. There's a town called Ards in Northern Ireland. And everyone keeps saying, oh, the song was originally called Girl from Ards. And
because that would really be, because that makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely, yeah. Like the whole point of a song is it's a sci-fi song and we're Star Wars obsessed.
And
So the Girl from Ards story, it's just like, it just keeps going. Like I keep hearing people talk about that. But it's like there's a lot of people in Northern Ireland who, you know, who'll claim that Brown Eyed Girl was written about their moms.
Lots of pressure for this record or no pressure in the long run?
Oh, well, there's actually a lot, but probably... I probably shouldn't have worried so much about it. You know, now it's out there. It's, you know, it's... I think, you know, we felt it was quite a big deal to come to make an album when we said we would never make... So we're like, it has to be... We're like, oh, this really has to match up to our very best ones. So we spent a lot of time agonizing over that. Whereas, you know, nowadays, I don't know, there's just not the same pressure on albums as there was, you know, when you used to, you know, in the days when people would sell a lot of them. Or when we would sell a lot of them.
People are so obsessed with the fact that you were influenced by U.S. bands in an era when you should have been influenced by, you know, U.K. bands. Yeah. But let's look at some of your brethren from Ireland. Let's not even pick the U.K. I don't think they were influenced by U.K. music. I think that they were influenced by American music in a massive way. Right?
Yeah, okay, yeah. You look at Van Morrison, definitely. You know, he's all about American music. Thin Lizzy, definitely influenced by American stuff. Even, like, the Undertones and the punk stuff. Like, the Undertones were all big Nuggets fans, so they were all about, like, the psychedelic sort of blues punky early, you know, proto-punk coming out of America. So New York Dolls, Ramones, they're all obsessed with that stuff.
There's also a big cultural, you know, I mean... Ireland is an island between, you know, obviously it's geographically closer to Britain, but, you know, there's people still have an affinity to America there as well. And I kind of, even whenever I was like in primary school, I made a school project and said, one day I'm going to live in America.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's like the whole, you know, the whole romance of like, you know, the other side of the ocean or whatever.
America has always been, and I'm going to put this in quotes, interesting for you. You've been through all these huge labels. And I'm going to just do this story for you about the DreamWorks guy who said, oh, you should be more like Papa Roach because that's what's happening now.
It was more like he was kind of saying, don't bother trying to make an a record for American radio because he was like, this is what it is. And yeah, I think he was basically saying, he sat us down to show us that and was like, you know.
This is not where it's going to happen and just get to understand. But you've never really, it's never been your track to say, you're perfectly happy that you're playing, and also you've become huge in other places where maybe that's okay too.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely, you know.
It's like you've sold records, you've had gold records, it's not like you've gone, you know, gone wanting or you wouldn't be together.
Absolutely, yeah, well, we really enjoy enjoy playing here. It doesn't quite matter to us. You know, we've done huge shows, like 135,000 people. Like,
yeah, you do all the UK festivals. You do all that.
We've done that kind of stuff, but I don't know, we get as much of a kick playing here, and we definitely put. It's quite a lot of effort for us to come and play here to hardly anyone, but we kind of, I don't know, it's kind of important to us.
There's five of us jumping in the van, you know, there's three of us and a tour manager and a sound guy, and then off we go. And it doesn't, you know, it's pretty low maintenance, but and pretty DIY, you know, we sell our own merch or whatever and, you know, load everything in, set it all up. It's fun. It's kind of what you got into the band in the first place for, you know.
But what's really fascinating is that what still counts is music and songs and the way that people ingest them, because of playlists, you know, it's someone else telling you your opinion, especially if it's an algorithm, right?
Yeah. That's the biggest relief, is that music didn't die when, you know, when that was a fear. Yeah. You know, definitely.
We're also lucky that we've been able to learn how to, like, produce our own stuff, and we've got, you know, even we were talking about this the other day, about how there's a lot of albums, a lot of new music getting made with just crappy production, because people don't have the money to produce stuff well.
So where was that moment where you woke up one day and realized that you could make a record on a computer, right? You could set up a bunch of microphones and you could do it, but then you said, wait a minute, that's not the kind of music that Ash is going to make. We need high production values. We want the meter to stay there because that's who we are as a band.
I think I just had a fear that there was going to get the industry was starting to cave in, and then we wouldn't be able to actually record at the same level as we'd always had. And
that there'd be no money.
And then there was the change in Pro Tools, and then also realizing that outboard equipment, you know, was getting, you could sort of buy just a few pieces to begin with and you'd be quite good to go. So like, you didn't, you know, in the old days you used to have to buy a few hundred thousand dollar recording, you know, console and stuff like that. And I guess Pro Tools really changed that. And but it was sort of like we needed to set ourselves up so we could be independent and keep making records no matter what.
But there is nothing like listening to something that comes through the right microphones and a Neve and all of that, right?
Yeah. We made a whole new album just using API preamps. Yeah. So that's the sound. Yeah. There's certain bits of gear you just get, and you're like,
wow. It's getting geeky, but my audience knows I do because I understand that stuff. Yeah. What's really fascinating is you've succeeded at, back to the non-influences we haven't talked about. Yeah. You've succeeded at being really loud in some cases. That meter does not move. I've watched it.
Yeah, yes.
Right? It is. You've slammed everything in and crushed it as much as you can. And yet, it's still pop songs. The longest songs, 4 minutes and 9 seconds. Yeah. Right? You didn't. And you've stuck to the whole idea of making, you know, rock pop songs and tons of melodies and even strings. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, we did those in British Grove in London, which is an amazing studio. But yeah, in some ways I failed, because I was like, okay, we've got to have a 3-minute rule on this album. But yeah, we went
over.
I love it. The Pixies albums are always like 2 minutes 15 and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm very.
But to make a loud record, I mean, the Ramones did it, you know, the Dolls did it, but. And those were, they never had long songs, but people make an assumption now that, you know, a loud song's gotta be epic.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Gotta repeat the middle 8 12 times to make sure it's...
Yeah, it was important for us to, I think we really wanted to refine simplicity. We were so, that was one of the things we were, like, looking back at our earlier albums, you know, when we couldn't play as well, and, you know, there's real simplicity because of that. There's a few songs I wrote on ukulele just to try to get that kind of, well, they came out quite good because they're so simple.
Evel Knievel.
Yeah.
That's pretty darn cinematic. That's Morricone, isn't it?
Yeah, big time Morricone influence.
Yeah. And then you did the video to go with it. And what everybody goes for is, wait a minute, why'd you make an instrumental? And the answer is, well, most songs that are cinematic, that are on movie soundtracks, don't tend to have vocals.
Yeah, no, I did a bit of soundtrack work over the last few years, so definitely wasn't so scared of instrumentals. And our manager, he came down to the string session for that song, and he was like, oh, this is loving this track. And it was only that night when we played it live that he realized that there was no vocals on it. He
was like, wait a minute. Yeah. And you had, and this is a great segue to do both, you had 40 songs to get down to the 12.
Yeah.
So did the manager go, okay, you got another 28 songs. Do you have to put the instrumental on the record?
Yeah. Well, it was one of his favorites, so luckily he was cool with it. But that's always that's kind of our ratio. We need to like write 3 times what we're going to actually eventually put out to sort of get the quality right. That's one of our rules.
Yeah. So the other thing, and this is important because the world we're talking about, people need to get to track 12. Yeah. They need to get there. Because as I was retracking it today, I'm like, oh my gosh. Because loud, and then you get to track 12. And we are we're in Los Angeles and we're on the beach and we're total full on harmonies and the guitar twang and all of that. And so when you were sequencing this thing, getting geeky, did you say, oh man, if people get to track 12, they're going to be like, oh my gosh.
I guess because we knew it was like, there's something nice about ending something on a sort of poignant, gentle kind of note. Right, so yeah. Right. It was actually Mark's idea to end the album with the two ballads as well.
What I've done is I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside, speaking of cinematic, and then songs by anybody else in between,